Some women impersonate Sex and the City's Carrie Bradshaw with vast closets full of fantastic clothing. Even Sarah Jessica Parker pretends to be Carrie Bradshaw when she walks the red carpet. However, there is one woman in New York City who, if he knew her, would have been Darren Star's real muse. Let me introduce you to Susan S. Warner, the adorable petite blonde who at 59 lost her handsome, extraordinary husband to cancer 6 months after her wonderful 32-year-old son died by suicide. It's now 4 years later. After the most challenging days and nights, Susan decided to live her best life possible. And just like that, Susan was suddenly single. Carrie may have Susan beat on exposure, but Susan has Carrie beat on life's experiences. Listen in.
Welcome to Susan Warner's podcast. Susan is suddenly single. This is Lois Whitman Hess. In all of our past podcasts, Susan Warner has talked about moving forward, not beyond, when you lose someone you love. To many of Susan's followers, her confidence and desire to live the best possible life may seem like she possesses an inner strength that they do not. She stresses that never in this journey has it been entirely easy or uncomplicated. This information will give her loyal listeners a true understanding of who Susan is, her struggles, and her triumphs. Susan, what were the first days like after your son's death and soon after your husband's prognosis and then death? What were you thinking?
That's a deep breath I just took. I want to start by saying that this is painful and difficult. And I want everybody to know that, and I think I've tried to state this journey is painful and difficult and not easy. And there are dark days. Every day is not a party. And I try to work through those, and there are more good days than bad days. So let me start by answering your question. David's death by suicide was earth-shattering. Losing a child is like no other death that you'll ever experience. And I hope that, I wish I could eradicate that for everybody. You lose a piece of your heart that never grows back and never closes. David was suffering. He had demons. He suffered from addiction. I had my husband and my daughter and my family and my friends surrounding me. David was a bigger than life person. He was magnanimous. He was loving. He was caring. He suffered from trying to be too much to too many people, and in that feeling that he was selling everyone short. And this is what I've talked about, that I think that suicide is selfless, not selfish. David felt he didn't deserve our love. He didn't deserve the good things. I tried desperately in the beginning to intellectualize his pain and then his death. That helped me a lot. And I was there to partner this with Michael, my husband, and my daughter and my family, who took the loss as difficultly as we did. A lot of it was numbness. A lot of it was trying to make everybody okay too. And because of the rituals of the Jewish religion where you sit Shiva, it gave me time to process everything. David's friends were also extraordinary. He had a huge cadre of friends, and they surrounded us as well. So my support system, and I've said this all along, was so wonderful. People not leaving us alone, not letting us suffer by ourselves. But there were the moments when we were alone that were so heavy and so dark. It was something that, it's a pain that is indescribable, the pain of losing a child. Then Michael. So Michael felt a very uncomfortable loss from David. They worked together. He felt a responsibility that he could not come to terms with. His prognosis and then his decline was so fast, 8 weeks, and so furious that I couldn't put my ducks in a row. I was just going through the motions. trying to believe that I could make him better, that he needed to be stronger, that we could move through this. But the decline was so rapid that it was evident, because it was an 8-week turnaround, that that wasn't going to happen. I tried to prepare for the future. It was silly. I didn't know what I was doing. I did think that I was in a box that was getting smaller and smaller and smaller till I couldn't breathe anymore. And I maybe I'm a little embarrassed by that, because I can't tell you every minute I was consumed with him. Sometimes I didn't know what to do with myself. It was hard, and it was dark, and it was difficult. We also got a lot of help from Rabbi Salt at Central Synagogue, who was certainly led me through the process, and a man in palliative care at Mount Sinai, who's a saint, named Dr. Sean Morrison, who helped me through the process. He's an angel. I don't know what I would have done without them. And they were at my house probably every other day helping us. So I had a lot of support. And I felt it was important in Michael's death to let people say goodbye. So I had arranged afternoons for his brothers and my brothers and dear friends to come and lay with him or sit with him and talk. And I think that was helpful to him and to them. And it made everybody a part of the process and hopefully feel more complete in his death. I was very concerned that Michael got enough and that the people that were so dear to us got enough to make people's transition easier.
So did Michael think there was any hope, or he knew, you know, that the end was near?
Michael was an optimist, and he hoped, and that's a word that I struggle with, the word hope. Hoping and hope are words that I really struggle with. He did not think it was quite as imminent as it was. It came on too fast. I'm not sure he processed the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he did. But as I've said in the past, sunset, when the day would dim, we would lay together and tell stories from meeting to our early days, to the birth of our children, to the joys in our life. We definitely felt fulfilled in our love for each other and our talking about what life meant to each other. I did. And that's where I encouraged family and, of course, my daughter to have those same moments with her father, to just lay in bed and talk to him. And we definitely talked out a lot and left not many stones unturned emotionally, which really helped a lot. I also felt that he was going to our son, and I was spiritually told that by our rabbi, and that brought me a lot of solace. And I talked to him about that. In fact, it was a really cute story that I said, you know, if you feel you need to go to David and David calls you, go. I get it. And he looked at me and he called me by the pet name that he only called me. And he said, well, how will I know? I said, honey, it's you, not me. I don't know how you're going to know.
Yeah.
But we laughed and we smiled and we held each other. And I believe ultimately that he went to David and they're together spiritually. I do.
So all I could say is, after listening to you, anyone that is listening to this podcast, if they don't think that you have deep feelings and you're just mispositive, then they are, completely, in denial themselves about trying to help themselves. Because as you always say, if you make the determination that you want to live, then you better live. Because otherwise you're just wasting, your life. So, but having said that, I'm just curious, going through this period and listening to you and, inserting my own brain in here, did you ever just want to be alone, or did you always feel that you had to be with family and friends?
You know, I started journaling from the time David died, just comments and points that I wanted to remember. And when I first thought I would write a book maybe one day, the title of my book was going to be, But You Get to Go Home. And that's how I felt. is that everybody was suffering and everyone felt my grief and felt their grief. But at the end of the day, they got to go home and live their life of normalcy. I didn't get to go home.
Right.
My home was this world. And it was 24/7, never ending. And I wanted to go home. I wanted to leave the scenario. And I never felt, that was an overwhelming feeling, was that I was totally enveloped by this without an escape. However, be that said, and I will again reiterate this because I've been told this by people from the outside too, how fortunate I am to have family and friends that are, were, and are so supportive. They were there for me. Some stronger than others, but they were there for me and they held Elizabeth and me up. And that was really, and my friends were extraordinary.
But Susan, a lot of people really, I know that you care about that, and that was like probably one of the most important things that happened, you know, the support that you got from family and friends to your survival. But a lot of people really are not either people persons, or they don't want to hear anything from anyone. They just want to be alone and completely, either suffer or process everything or stay mm-hmm. calm or ride a bicycle or whatever. That's their escape. So it's interesting yeah. that you, yeah. So what
that's
is
their
comment,
choice. And that,
what is your comment about
their,
that?
That's their choice. You know, I think my daughter stayed with me for about a week. And then we looked at each other and said, you know, you got to go home. Mm-hmm. I've got to move forward. And I did something that is the cardinal sin of grief is I put our family apartment on the market. Michael died in March. I put it on the market in September because every night, every day, there he was at the front door. There he was in the bathroom. I saw him in every corner.
Wow.
And I couldn't live that way. I couldn't do it. I saw him on the couch. I saw him everywhere. And even my dog Winston waited for him to come home. It didn't work for me. And when Michael was very, very sick, we have a home out east, and he said to me, I understand if you want to sell this apartment, please don't sell the house out east. And I lived by that. And for me, it was the smartest move I ever made. I sold the apartment in 6 days. I moved to another neighborhood. I rented a little jewel box that was all mine, that Michael wasn't there. To this day, when I walk down 90th Street in Riverside, where we lived, I still see him coming down the street in his, you know, black sweater and black pants and so handsome and smiling and yelling out my name. And now the trigger is heartwarming. In the beginning, I could hardly breathe. There's a particular restaurant up there that we used to sit at the bar on cold winter nights and have dinner together. And I couldn't even look at it. And I'd walk by and cry and say, I'm never going to sit at that bar again with him and have dinner. And I miss it so much. But again, I have never gone back there, and I don't have to. I'll make other stories. I'll make other memories. But there are still triggers. There's still pain. But I'm making another chapter. I'm moving forward with him on my shoulder. It was mm-hmm. Father's Day this weekend, and I went to the cemetery. It was brutal. It was brutal. You know, I miss him every day. But there are new relationships to forge and new experiences to have and more of me to grow and discover. And that's how I look at it, with Michael on my shoulder, with David on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. How I see it.
Did you think that you could cope, or did you teach yourself to cope?
Because I lost my mother at a very young age and I coped, I was pretty confident that I was going to move forward. And I've told the story that when Michael's prognosis was bad in the hospital at the onset of his diagnosis, I said to my daughter, we're going to move on to the next chapter. This is not the end for us. So as far as coping skills go, I always knew I wanted to live. I always knew that there was another chapter. So I can confidently answer that one. that I knew I was going to jump into this world and move forward.
You see, that's the soundbite that a lot of people can't relate to. And it's amazing that you said that, because a lot of us, all we want to do is walk around and say, why me, why me, why me? Did you ever think that? I mean, did you ever pull your hair out of your head? Did you ever say, oh, my God, you know, I can't go on. I mean, not that you were going to do anything to yourself, but like you would just like, you know, lay in bed for the next, you know, 50 years. You know, you never had those feelings like, I can't, you know, I'm just like a wet rag. I can't move. I can't shake. I can't think. I can't produce. You know, that's what a lot of...
I think you want me to say yes, but the answer is no. I am a survivor. I want to live my best life. I'm going to take all those 38 extraordinary years with my husband and 34 magnificent years with my son, and I'm going to bank them. And I'm going to say that lots of people don't get that in a whole lifetime of relationships. And I'm going to hold them in my heart, and I'm going to make them a part of me, and I'm going to move forward and onto the next chapter. Not going to ever let them go. But no, I didn't. I've never had the desire to stop. I want to be the best version of me. I want to live my best life. And
so
a lot of
people are listening to that. And I think that, and I'm not trying to, you know, brown nose you, but I think that's an extraordinary thing to say and an extraordinary piece of advice. You know, sometimes if people could fake it until they make it, those lines mm-hmm. are very important for all of us mm-hmm. that, you know, and we could apply that to anything, you know, gaining a lot of weight, you know, losing a job, you know, not having a good relationship with a friend. You know, if you just take the words you just said, and whether you believe it or not, and just do it, you know, maybe you can get yourself out of a situation. But it's extraordinary, Susan. Maybe you don't realize it. I don't know. That's a whole other podcast. What makes you really understand that? I mean, I've been asking you this for 7 podcasts already.
Right,
I
have explained also that I come from a very strong matriarchy. My grandmother, who I was very close to, lost both her daughters in their 40s and still would say, hi, babe, how are you? I'm good. Mm-hmm. She also embraced life. My mother was sick at an early age and still lived with gusto until she didn't. Maybe it's DNA. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just DNA, you know, and I see that I've raised a strong, resilient daughter. So maybe it's DNA. But it's that overwhelming desire that I got one shot at this, Lois, one shot, and I'm going to give it everything I've got.
Oh, my God.
And there are good days and bad days.
Those are extraordinary words also, one shot.
It is. It's one shot, and I've got to make the most of it. And that's why, you know, I talked about, you know, I've loved and I've lost, and I'm going to live life my way and do what I want, when I want, with whom I want. And not in a hurtful way, in a way that I'm going to go for the gusto. I want to be happy, and I want to be good, and I want to be remembered for what I've contributed, and that I've loved, and that I love, and that I've been loved, and that I care, and I want to be that person. And that's what pushes me forward.
Well, that's pretty amazing. This is mm-hmm. a gift that you have that other people mm-hmm. will just have to learn, you know, to follow, and then maybe they'll get the gift too, you know.
Being tested, I will tell you that.
Say that again, I didn't hear you.
I'd like to stop being tested, I will tell you that. Well, I think I've had enough tests in life, you know, like let's coast.
I thought you meant like people asking you questions about
mean, I'd like to stop being tested. I don't know that you get that, you know, you don't make that choice, but I would like the test to kind of come to
I understand.
A little bit of an end. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't enjoy the process, I'll tell you that.
This no, no, of course
to.
Not. But you certainly, you know, I think I understand you much better now through this podcast, and I hope our listeners do too, that, you know, this is who you really are, and you're not, you
yep.
know, pretending that, you know, that this comes easy or that everyone should completely be like you, but it gives people, for anyone that wants to learn, they're certainly hearing every guideline that they ever have to hear in order to make their life better and not be miserable for the rest of their lives. Because
I'd like
so
to
many,
help. I'd like
yeah.
to. I'd like to help. You know, you asked me. You once asked me a question about what were the worst times. You know. You know. Was it
right.
days, nights, walking the dog? And it's funny for me. One of the huge obstacles for me were meals. Michael and I would have dinner together most nights, and Michael had a bad gallbladder, and I used to cook to make sure that his diet was what it should be. And we would sit across from each other for a solid 2 hours at night and talk. So that ritual became torturous for me, and I didn't eat. I just skipped it, and I got extremely thin, dangerously thin. And I read an article in the Times about other, particularly widows and widowers, that if they ate breakfast together every morning, she or he couldn't eat breakfast anymore. And with reading it and understanding that I wasn't alone in that, I learned how to manage that much better. And that helped a lot. Again, leaving the environment I was in, leaving my apartment and moving into my place where it was my own footprint really helped a lot. There was one experience where I was in Michael's closet after he had died, trying to clean it out, and I sat on the floor and cried. And my sister-in-law, Angie, who has been instrumental in helping me as support, called me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm sitting in Michael's closet crying." She said, "Get dressed. We're going to the Whitney." And I did. I threw on clothes. I got out of the closet, and we went to the Whitney for the night and had a glass of wine, and life was better. When I get sad, and even today, or I get spinning, I put the leash on the dog and go for a walk. That was mm-hmm. is enormously therapeutic for me. Get out in the world, you know, smile at someone, see someone. You know, it goes along with that whole you get what you give thing. Give directions to someone on the street. Go to the park. See the beauty. Watch what's going on. Get out of your own head. That's really helpful to me.
Well, so did you ever feel like on the outside looking in? I mean, this is what was happening yeah. to you, and that's what I could relate to. It certainly feels like, you know, that you're like watching everybody else and like, you know, progressing, but your life had came to a halt. So how did you deal
sometimes,
with that?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes I would walk through the city and think that either I had two choices. One, it was a relief that everybody walking past me didn't know what I had gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Or how could everybody be carrying on their life after what I've gone through? So it went either way. Sometimes the anonymity was great, and sometimes I just wanted to scream. And that played out. You know, there were people that I would see after the tragedies happened, and I would try to avoid them because I knew I was going to have to go through that whole cock their heads and say I'm sorry. And then there were people that I would see on the street that would purposely cross to the other side so they didn't have to see me and say that. So it worked both ways. It was kind of double-edged. I don't know which one I preferred. There was a lot of that. Now that it's 4 years since the death of my son and the death of my husband, I'm starting to believe it doesn't define me anymore, which is good. And on the other side of that is I can't say that I was recently widowed anymore, and that hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That it's pushing to the past. So everything seems to have a yin and a yang, which is kind of interesting, and you need to balance those off depending on the day, depending on the head, depending on how good I feel about myself or where I am in a relationship or, you know, what the trigger was. But they do pop up all the time. I'm not going to tell you that every day I skip outside and say it's good to be alive. There are times
right.
that it's harder than others.
So that leads me to ask you, did you have crying sessions, panic attacks, sudden health issues? Who were you?
Okay, the operative word there is did you in the past? Do I in the present? Of course I do. I had a health issue that I thought was something that I went to the doctor immediately, and it was the fact that because I wasn't eating, my GI system had filled up with air, and yeah, I had health issues and panic attacks. Yeah, yeah, crying sessions. Yeah,
I can't even imagine you with a panic attack.
They're not my big thing. Panic attacks aren't my big thing, but you know, would I walk down the street and cry? Yeah. You know, did I cry Sunday at the cemetery? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I find that I talk to Michael and David sometimes in the park, usually alone. You know, the greatest invention are earbuds, because you can talk and everyone thinks you're on the phone.
Right.
You don't have to be, so I don't look crazy.
God. Mm-hmm.
But I can have full conversations that are really wonderful, that really helped me through something with both of them. So all those things still happen. They still happen. But, you know, there was someone made a line to me when I first was in this grief, that it's not that the pain gets less. It's the time between the pain gets less frequent. And that is definitely true.
That's powerful also.
And it's true, and I didn't make it up. It's true. The hurt's still there, and it can be overwhelming. But the time between the pain is further apart, mm-hmm. and that helps. You know, anniversaries still happen, Mother's Day, Father's Day, birthdays, you know, Shiva, you know, your site, they all still happen. Some years are easier, some years are harder. I actually would like to explore why some years are easier and some years are harder, but they are. And it's all still there, but the good days outweigh the bad, and they get more and more and more. And that's wonderful. You know, I credit President Biden. He had a statement, and I'm going to paraphrase him, where he said that the day that you can tell those stories and laugh instead of cry is the day that you've evolved. And I believe that.
Mm.
And I found that it's true. As time passes, you tell stories and you laugh at their faults and you laugh at the things they did or the stories that occurred instead of crying. And that's when you fully get to appreciate who they are and not what they were. And that's been a huge evolution for me. And I think if most people take the time to realize that, you will realize that you will grow into the laughter and the smile and hopefully, you know, devolve from the crying as much.
So after hearing that, so what do you think, just so our listeners get a better idea, what were your biggest challenges?
Mm.
I mean, you may
my biggest challenges.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've said this before. My biggest challenges were that because I am strong, that my husband loved to try to take care of me, and there were some things that I was didn't know. Financially, I was a little bit in the dark. To this day, I still can't book an airline flight. He and my daughter were travel freaks. And as much as she has forced my hand to take control and been very supportive, she still books my flights for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned, if you teach me, I can do it. That was the biggest thing. So if it's taking care of the landscaping at my house, which my husband did, and now I do with great pride and it's beautiful, or it's putting a chair together that I never had to do because he was the handy one, I can be as proud of myself as that as turning out a great essay for a magazine. Because if you teach me, I can learn. I can do it. And that accomplishment in little things and big things has made me grow and be better. And that's been very gratifying. Very gratifying. So it's everything from, you know, the hydrangea to the hose to writing a book that I am doing right now.
Right. So
teach me.
Yeah. So this podcast is running very long, but you've said something several times on several of the podcasts, and I really want to cover it here before we end this podcast. But I think, like a lot of the things you say, you said that through routines, you learned to discipline yourself to feel better. You didn't let the world overwhelm you, because you knew when certain things were happening, holidays or feelings or you know, events that you had to go to, so that you formed a routine in your life that you could then move forward. Can you address that for us at all?
Yes, and that was a real evolution. You know, a lot of it was necessity being the mother of invention. So I need to drive out east. Michael always did the driving. I don't love driving back into the city. Put your big girl pants on and drive back into the city. You know, you can do it. Holidays were an experimentation. So one Mother's Day I spent with my family, and there was a mother there being celebrated by her children. And it was so intensely painful to me. I said, well, I'm never doing this again. Like, I've learned. And yes, routines help. Do the things that you're comfortable with. Keep going with what you do, you know. Yes, but I've changed a lot of those patterns. Like, I've learned my husband and I at night would stay in the den until 11 o'clock till we walk the dog, even though I wanted to get into bed earlier. Michael would like that. Well, now I get into bed when I want and either watch Netflix or read a book. It could be 8 o'clock. So, yes, routines helped, but I've developed my own, and that makes it my own, which is really helpful. It was like moving, developing my own routines that didn't put me in the triggers of this is what Michael and I did. Which is why, even relationship-wise, I'm not looking to replicate what I had. I'm looking to develop something new. And that helps me a lot. You know, I don't want to be who I was. I want to be the new Susan. And
so does the new Susan
helps.
Avoid situations that would make you feel bad? Is that what you're telling other people to do?
That's what I'm telling you, yes. Yes, yes. I guess I wasn't succinct enough.
No, you were. You were. You were very. I just wanted to underscore.
Yes.
Would you say, is that a selfish thing, or do you have
no,
to eventually
self-preservation.
Learn to?
It's
go
self-preservation.
Ahead.
So I've discussed this wedding of a very good friend of my son's that I'm going to in July. And I RSVP'd to her, I can go to the cocktail hour, but I can't go to the dinner. I can see all of David's friends and I can't wait and I can have a glass of wine with them, but I'm not prepared to take it to the next step. It took a lot to say that, to admit that. And she was so understanding. And people are very understanding. If I think I have limitations, if I know something is going to hurt me, I've learned to say no. In the beginning, I was like, you know, it's my responsibility to shoulder it and tough it out. And no, it's not. Self-preservation. Do what works for you. And if you can't do something, don't do it. If something you know is going to hurt you or cause pain, and you think that it may not be the air quote right thing to do, self-preservation. It's not going to effectuate other people. It's not going to make enough of a difference in their life, but it could make a difference in yours. Follow your instincts. Follow your gut. Do what will make you the most comfortable and the happiest without, of course, hurting people. I don't mean that. But if you have triggers, if you have things that you know, you think it's the right thing to do, but it's going to hurt you, don't do it. Don't
so
do it. Do what works for you.
Were there things that you didn't want to do and you didn't do it, but now you feel more comfortable doing it?
Yes. Yes, of course. Of course. So, you know, doing things alone used to be really hard. And I used to feel awkward. I'm more confident now than I used to be. I don't feel like people look at me as poor Susan. You know, I think I've grown past that. And I know that other families, I was talking to a family recently who had lost a son, and he still, after years, can't go to an event because he feels that people are looking at him as a father who lost a son. They're not.
Wow.
And you need to get past that. So part of it is your own perception and part of it is reality. And I think I'm moving past that, that I'm developing Susan as a new persona. And people are accepting that and reacting to me that way. So, yes, things that I couldn't do before, I find easier. Things that I know I can't do, I avoid. And things that I thought I had to do because it was the right thing to do, but that were hurtful, I don't do anymore.
That's wonderful.
So that's real growth.
That's real growth. I think that is amazing, amazing advice and amazing insight and gives people a sense of relief that they may never, that they're suffering for. I hope everyone in the world is going to listen to that because I'm going to tell everybody, start at the end and go backwards. That's wonderful.
But remember, these are the things
that
worked for me.
Say that. Yeah.
But remember, these are the things that worked for me, and there's no prescription in this. And if you can take away one thing that maybe worked for me that I could help someone through, that same man who felt that people were defining him by the death of his son, his wife didn't feel that way. She was talking about a wedding that was coming up of her son's friend, and she wanted to go and the husband didn't. I said, go. Just go to the ceremony and leave. You'll feel empowered. There's a whole lot of empowerment when you conquer something that you choose to and that makes you feel good. And that's part of this. And some of it is finding the independence and finding the ability to pick and choose, to make those decisions, and then act on them. And that empowerment makes you that whole new person. And that's, I think, the strongest thing that I've embraced.
Susan, this has been an amazing experience, even for me to listen to. It is just...
Thank you for listening.
You could apply these the conversation we had and the advice that you have given out to so many things in life that, you know, it just, it could make someone's, it could turn around someone's life and relieve them of such burdens that they have and thoughts that they have. Oh, my God, this is amazing. I hope all of this gets into your essays. This is a lifesaver.
Thank you.
This is not a typical motivational, you know, book that you're writing or podcast you're giving. This is true advice that maybe even a therapist who hasn't been through this could not possibly give this kind of information, because you've given a lot of thought to it and you've exercised through it. So it's pretty amazing.
It is. It's all truthful and it's all from the heart. That I will give you.
Well, God bless you and thank you. This has really been terrific.
Thank you.
This is podcast number 8. We'll see you at podcast number 9.
Thanks, Lois. Bye-bye.
Thank you.